Hi, everyone. I'm Melody Maraca.
And I'm Bill C.
Welcome back to the Into the Heart of U2 podcast, where two longtime fans discuss U2 music album by album and tour by tour, the fan experience, and the perception of U2 and cultural consciousness.
Right. Melody and I, we came of age with U2. We saw it all happen in real time. And as we sit here in 2024, we still care about this band. But we're concerned about their legacy. So, as we take a trip back through the band's history, we're going to try and place it in proper context, and ultimately, get to the bottom of whether U2 is one of the greats of all time, or are the haters right after all? So, Melody, why don't you tell everyone what we're on about today?
Well, we're going to be talking about the band's 12th studio album, No Line on the Horizon, with its, for U2, poor sales, mixed reviews, and in some quarters, lukewarm reaction from fans. No Line on the Horizon is an album the band appeared happy to see in the rearview mirror. But whether you love it, hate it, or have a more complicated opinion, you have to agree that this is the last time the band leaned into their experimental side.
All very true. But before we get into it, why don't you first remind everyone where we left off last episode?
Sure. The band had finished up the hugely successful Vertigo tour on the heels of the commercial smash of How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. Their stock was peaking, and U2 certainly had become a huge global brand. But the prevailing feeling was the band had settled into a safe landing spot and had ceased pushing creative boundaries.
That's right. And for some context, and you know how I love context. It was 4 years between All That You Can't Leave Behind and How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, and it ends up being another 4.5 years between How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb and No Line on the Horizon. But let's remember, when we talk about the making of Boy, October, War, Unforgettable Fire, Joshua Tree, Octoon Baby, Zooropa, and Pop, we're talking about U2 getting down in the trenches and not coming out until the work is done. But in the 2000s, certainly for parts of Atomic Bomb, and definitely on No Line on the Horizon, and moving forward, U2, having become a massive global brand, as you mentioned, start working in stops and starts, tending to band business, family matters, and of course, there's Bono's activism. So, as the months drag into years, other mitigating factors start to infringe on record making and alter the vision of each successive record. So, what once was a voyage of discovery on those earlier records with no distractions, we start seeing brand protection rear its head and they become obsessed with this idea of staying relevant, something that is a very big factor in what ends up on No Line on the Horizon.
Much to the album's detriment, in my opinion.
Agreed. Now, a lot of people think that No Line on the Horizon sessions first started in September 2006 at Abbey Road Studios with Rick Rubin producing. I do not. Because other than Window in the Sky and the Saints Are Coming cover with Green Day, both of which land on the U2 18 singles collection, The Edge made it clear they set everything else aside from those Rick Rubin sessions, and all the writing for No Line on the Horizon was done after that. So there you go.
So what then was the thinking for a new record?
Well, in January 2007, we have Bono saying, quote, "We're going to continue to be a band, but maybe the rock will have to go. Maybe the rock has to get a lot harder. But whatever it is, it's not going to stay where it is," end quote. And then this from The Edge, quote, "We're fighting for our relevance. We feel like we can't really afford not to be innovative," end quote.
Right. And then Larry said, quote, "We needed to get back to something that was going to inspire us to take more risks and not to be afraid," unquote.
Yeah. And look, after two straight conventional and commercially successful records in All That You Can't Leave Behind and Atomic Bomb, the time was certainly right to explore something different and go someplace else to do it. Now, right around this time, Bono gets invited to the World Sacred Music Festival in Fez, Morocco, taking place in May 2007. He asks the band if they'd be interested in coming along and seeing what might happen creatively in that environment. To his surprise, they were all down.
So it's not surprising that the World Sacred Music Festival would be of interest to the band, with the festival's mission to promote unity among individuals of all races and religions through spiritual and humanitarian values. The festival, which is still active, includes concerts, debates, and joint performances of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian devotional music from artists from all over the world. It's a type of illustration of the coexist image used by the band extensively on the Vertigo tour. Now, in addition to getting the band to head to Fez, Bono also asked Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois to join them, this time not just as producers, but also as songwriting partners.
That's right. And as we touched on in our All That You Can't Leave Behind episode, this co-writing partnership with Eno and Lanois was actually brokered with the help of Paul McGuinness as a peace offering because Eno was so upset the band continually failed to credit his contributions, which apparently almost ruined the friendship. So, right before they meet up with Eno and Lanois in Fez, U2 appears at the Cannes Film Festival for the unveiling of their 3D concert film, U2 3D, cobbled primarily from two shows in Buenos Aires on the Vertigo tour. Prior to the screening, the band played a brief live set on the famous red carpet steps of the Palais des Festivals.
Right. And as we mentioned during our last episode, the film goes on to be a huge critical success and profitable as far as concert films go. Okay. U2 and Eno and Lanois land in Fez in late May 2007 and spend 2 weeks recording in the courtyard, or Riad, of the Riad El Yacourt Hotel. Local musicians, including oud and violin players and percussionists, occasionally join the sessions. And Eno asked Larry to play an electronic drum kit, which Larry said, along with listening to Arabic rhythms, made him rethink his drumming. And even Larry was unrestrained, for Larry, in his excitement about the Fez sessions. He said, quote, "It's kind of nice to bathe in making music like this. Normally, we have to get a song finished, but here, we're going through lots of different ideas, finishing out some, getting them to a certain point, and then leaving it to see what might happen," unquote.
So while in Fez, they managed to record early versions of several songs that end up on the album, including the title track, Magnificent, Moment of Surrender, Fez, and Unknown Caller. They also get early incarnations of stand-up comedy, White as Snow, and even an Eno-inspired piece called Diorama, which ultimately morphs into If I Don't Go Crazy. Lanois said, quote, "The initial conversation was about future hymns. Bono thought that we have to go to Morocco and write a body of work that would qualify as hymns for the future, songs that you can sing that will last forever," end quote. Okay, well, maybe it was unrealistic to hope for a cross between The Unforgettable Fire and Zaropa, but considering how much the band talked about what an experience it was in Fez compared to what ended up on No Line on the Horizon, there was a prevailing sense the band didn't take it far enough. And I think that's why so many people feel No Line on the Horizon fell short of expectations. I know I did.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think the band, really Bono and his very early promotion of the album, did the band and the album a disservice by signaling what a milestone the record would be. He said that they were attempting to recapture, quote, "the transition that took us from the Joshua Tree to Octung Baby," unquote. Now, I have come to really love this record, or more accurately, a big part of this record, but I sort of had to tune out some of my earlier expectations to get there.
Now, I don't think No Line on the Horizon is the worst U2 album, but for me, it's always felt like the most disappointing. I mean, when I heard they were off to Fez to record with Eno and Lanois, I was thrilled. And I know a lot of fans of U2's more experimental work were too. You know, I'm a huge fan of exotic, Arabic, and Middle Eastern music, and Sufi singing, and all the rest. But I always assume they didn't take it farther because they lost their nerve and didn't want to forsake commercial viability. And while I do think that did play a part, I came across some quotes, most tellingly, from Brian Eno that explains why they didn't or couldn't build the record entirely around the Fez sessions, or even rely on the kind of kismic energy they hoped these experiments would yield. Eno said, and I quote, "None of the experimental music really appeared on the record because it sounded kind of synthetic, like world music add-on. It just didn't sound convincing. There was no realistic or emotionally satisfying way of marrying it using the music that we were doing, so in the end, not very much of it showed through," end quote.
Yeah, and then there's this quote from Larry, which is, quote, "At a certain stage, reality hits you, and you go, what are we going to do with this stuff? Are we going to release this sort of meandering experimentation? Are we going to knock some songs out of this?" Unquote.
And finally, Eno said this, quote, "We actually did record some local musicians playing along with us, but I felt it made the music sound a little bit self-consciously worldly, and we ended up not using them. It just seemed like a different musical language, and we didn't want to just graft it on to what we were doing," end quote. You know, and it's true, because other than the chanting on Unknown Caller and some sounds grafted onto Fez and Cedars of Lebanon, there's no Arabic scales or Middle Eastern, you know, drones or anything else indigenous to North Africa on this record. So to me, it feels like a good idea that they just weren't able to pull off musically. And this harkens back to what we talked about last episode. U2 has never had the musical chops to just slide into different styles of music. I mean, that's what gave them their own style, the fact that they couldn't play other people's music. Bono concedes, quote, "We went so far out on the Sufi singing and the sort of ecstatic music front that we had to ground it and find a counterpoint," end quote.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting, too, that it wasn't for lack of trying to get the Arabic feel on the record, but some sort of inability to get that marriage right. And all the hyperbolic messaging that had been done in the 18 months before the album's release about the North African stuff and about the experimentation didn't do them any favors.
And they compounded the problem during the promo for the album's release by going back to Fez to shoot some footage to recreate them making the music, which again gave the impression they'd captured all this magic indigenous to the region.
Yeah, we'll get into all of this in much more detail when we talk about the album song by song. But even without an Arabic or North African feel, I think that there's quite a lot on this record that feels fresh and in my mind relevant, but just not in the way that the band was defining relevance. And I think second guessing themselves and pulling back from the musical experimentation in order to create more accessible songs led to incoherence.
That's putting it kindly.
Well, at the time their album was released, Bono defended this decision to pursue more accessible pop-forward songs on the album by saying, quote, "When rock music forgets about the 45, it tends towards progressive rock, which is like a mold that grows on old, burnt-out artists who've run out of ideas. We have a soundtrack, Pink Floyd side to our band, and it has to be balanced by fine songwriting. And it's an infuriating thing for me to see indie rock and roll give up the single to R&B and hip-hop," unquote. Now, later, Bono would concede that they didn't pull off the pop songs on the record.
I mean, that really is the issue. Had the so-called more commercial songs they added to the record in the home stretch been stronger, there'd be nothing to talk about. Because in the end, if you have enough great songs, no one focuses on what the record was supposed to be.
True. And I think that Edge put it best years following the album's release when he said, quote, "I think we probably should have said, it's an experimental work. That's what it is," unquote.
1,000%.
But we are getting way ahead of things here. So why don't you go ahead and pick the story back up, Bill?
All right. So after leaving Fez in June 2007, enthused with how exhilarating the experience was, there was talk of releasing the record by the end of 2007. But when the band gets back to Dublin, they get distracted by other business, like the revamp of their ownership stake in the Clarence Hotel into a 5-star hotel and spa. Then there was the 200 million euro skyscraper project called U2 Tower, a proposal of luxury apartments, 2 floors of which dedicated to the band's new recording studio, and that would sit at the mouth of Dublin Bay. The band also took time out to put together the 20th anniversary of the Joshua Tree record that came out November 20th, 2007. This included a remaster of the original album, personally overseen by The Edge, which included a bonus disc with all the B-sides from the Joshua Tree singles and other unreleased tracks from the sessions, and notably finishing up one of those unreleased tracks called Waves of Sorrow. Bono's new lyrics and vocals are actually really something, and I find it kind of fascinating that they were working on this in the middle of No Line on the Horizon. What do you think of Waves of Sorrow, by the way? I didn't even ask you.
I like the song.
Yeah, I actually like it a lot. I think they only performed once at some small little benefit thing, not even with the whole band. So why don't we take a listen?
Yeah, I think you're right. On its knees, and if the rain came. Wash us all away. And another project that Bono and Edge were well into working on during the same time frame was writing songs for what would become the Broadway musical Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark. By late 2007, Bono and Edge were workshopping the first draft of the script and songs with writer-director Julie Taymor. Now, the fate of the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, both commercially and legally, may be more interesting than the actual musical turned out to be. But in 2007, and for the next few years while in development, Bono and Edge were excited to work on the project, particularly to work with Taymor, who had an impressive resume as an opera and Broadway director, and most notably with her work on The Lion King live musical, and well as her work as a film director. Bono had even done an extended cameo in Taymor's Beatles jukebox musical movie, Across the Universe. I'm sure that was one of your favorites, Bill.
That wasn't for me, but it was basically harmless.
Bono was also interested in having U2 re-record the Spider-Man songs and release them as a U2 album at some point. But reportedly, Larry wasn't having any of it, calling the whole Spider-Man thing, quote, a Bono and Edge project, unquote. Although the band did end up playing one song from the musical, Boy Falls from the Sky, which I like, once during the 360 tour.
I actually like that song, too. And another one from Spider-Man called Rise Above. Remember that one?
Yeah.
But I do agree with Larry. I mean, to turn that into a U2 record would have been like Bono and Edge, like handing the rest of the band a finished product instead of it being something, you know, organically created.
Very true. Very true.
Okay, back to business distractions. In March 2008, U2 struck a 12-year deal with Live Nation to take over the band's merchandise, digital, and branding rights, as well as touring. Besides the $100 million up front, U2 also received Live Nation stock that they ended up selling for over $25 million. Not bad, considering there was a huge recession taking place. Nice work, if you can get it. In any case, needless to say, with all this going on, No Line on the Horizon was no closer to being finished. But in stops and starts, the band does resume work on the record in a variety of studios and locations in Dublin, New York, and London, spending months tearing the tunes apart and reassembling them bit by bit, with Steve Lillywhite being called in once again to get them to the finish line.
Right. And it was during this period, in retrospect, that Brian Eno bemoaned the fact that the band literally spent months on the songs that were slated to be radio singles, while some of the more experimental works were discarded. Speaking of which, why don't we talk about some of the tunes that the band were working on for the album that didn't make the final cut?
Right. The band will tell you they had about 50 pieces recorded, but as we've mentioned on prior episodes, when U2 says that, they mean they had, you know, that many jams or fragments of ideas, only some of which ever making it to the final mixing stage. One of those pieces that did get finished is a song called Soon. And if you remember, for the majority of the 360 tour, the band came on stage to a tape of a largely instrumental song, Well, that was something recorded in Fez, originally called Kingdom of Your Love, before being renamed Soon, which I really like. This song ends up being a double-sided single on vinyl included with the U2 Rose Bowl DVD. Back several episodes ago, I bemoaned the fact that U2 stopped including these kinds of experimental pieces on their records, like The Ocean, Scarlet, Promenade, and MLK. Well, I think Soon is a nice throwback to one of those kinds of lovely musical interludes, if you want to call it that. And I really wish they'd found a place for it on No Line on the Horizon.
Oh, I agree. I think this should have been on the album. I think it's almost criminal that it wasn't. I really love this song.
Agreed. So let's take a listen to that. We spent plenty of time last episode talking about the cult status of the song Mercy, which was the last song cut from How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. Another song is North Star, which is super catchy, that also got the axe. And while both of those got worked on again for No Line on the Horizon, there's really no evidence either was seriously in contention for the final cut of the record. But they were both played about a dozen times on the 360 tour, which we'll touch on in our tour section in a bit. And I, for one, would have preferred it over a couple other songs on this record, that being Get On Your Boots and Stand Up Comedy, but we'll get to that. Also, during Bono's trip to Africa on a break from the Vertigo tour in summer 2006, he wrote the lyrics for a song called Love Is All We Have Left. At the time, he thought he had written a Frank Sinatra song, and at one point during the lead-up to the release of No Line on the Horizon, it was slated to make the record. But of course, it doesn't emerge until later as the opening track to Songs of Experience. I imagine in a very different incarnation, considering Bono's Brush with Mortality, as it was called in December 2016, that altered the tone of that record.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, quite honestly, I didn't remember hearing that Love Is All We Have Left was developed during this time. Very interesting. I learned something. I learn a lot of things every time we do these the research for the episodes.
See the kind of kernels we uncover here on the podcast, Melanie?
Okay. Then we have Every Breaking Wave, which was slated to be on No Line until very, very late in the game. Bono would go on to state that it would be the first single on the mythical and yet to transpire Songs of Ascent album.
Now, no studio recording of Every Breaking Wave has surfaced from this period, but judging from the version they played on the 360 tour, it still didn't have that great soaring chorus part that goes, if you go, your way, I go mine, that thing. We'd come to learn that that chorus was added later during the making of Songs of Innocence with the help of One Republic frontman Ryan Tedder. But let's listen to the version they played on 360 in 2010. I can only assume this is the arrangement they had during the No Line sessions, and it's a good thing they didn't put it on No Line, because the chorus here, I think, is a real dud. So let's listen.
You You know, the story goes that it was Chris Martin from Coldplay who advised the band that Every Breaking Wave wasn't finished and it deserved to be.
Can I just point out that Coldplay has a song called Paradise that came out in 2011 and has a striking resemblance to Every Breaking Wave? Obviously, he heard the song while he was gestating in 2010. So Chris Martin tells you two to hold back Every Breaking Wave. Coincidence? What? Okay, I'll put away my tinfoil hat.
You know, I think that's best. And I'll get myself into big trouble if I talk about how much Coldplay borrowed from, was inspired by U2's music. So I think maybe we should move along.
Well, it's not like that's a secret. Anyway, as things get closer to the finish line, the band's second guessing starts to creep in, and they go off and write Get On Your Boots, re-record Breathe, dramatically transform stand-up comedy, and turn Eno's embryonic idea called Diorama into a poppier incarnation called I'll Go Crazy If I Don't Go Crazy Tonight, with the help of Will.i.am of Black Eyed Peas. Now, this all starts to tilt things away from what they initially promised into a mixed bag of half-committed experimental songs and obvious attempts at chasing a hit.
Right. And with no agreement on how to achieve a cohesive single album, the band consider releasing two EPs and then later two full-length albums. They were thinking of calling Daylight and Darkness and later Sunrise and Sunset, before deciding against that idea and postponing the release, stating that they needed even more time to write new material.
Then, just before Christmas 2008, they turn the record in, but then pull it back at the last minute to rejigger the track order, taking Fez Being Born out of the lead track position, which I think was a huge mistake, for the catchier title song. And as we just mentioned, they drop both Every Breaking Wave and a song called Winter to ensure there's room for stand-up comedy, If I Don't Go Crazy, and Get On Your Boots. Of the last minute changes, The Edge said, quote, "It was a conscious thing for us to make a collection that was a whole. It's part of why it all took so long. We were fighting to hold on to the idea that an album can still be a sacred art form," end quote. But was it? I mean, personally, I think the original vision for the record was captured a little closer, although not entirely, by the film they commissioned Anton Corbijn to make called Linear.
Right. So why don't we go ahead and discuss Linear? The film was conceived by Bono and directed by, as you mentioned, U2's longtime visual collaborator, Anton Corbijn. It was meant to be a companion piece that would visually integrate some No Line on the Horizon's thematic ideas and provide an enhanced way to experience the album. It was filmed in France and Spain in July 2008 and originally edited in August of that year. It was ultimately made available for download or on DVD in conjunction with several of the released album formats.
Okay. The plot of Linear was very loosely based on characters Bono created for the album, with a story revolving around a Parisian motorcycle cop who's become disillusioned with his life, causing him to leave and go to visit his girlfriend in Tripoli. But as the band continued to work into December 2008, the film became out of sequence with what was to be included on the album. By the way, what did you think of Linear? I mean, like, as a film?
Frankly, I thought it was pretty dull. And I don't think it was successful in its purpose, as a way to heighten the listening experience of the album, frankly.
Yeah, it's a snooze. I mean, it really is.
Succinctly put. Yeah. It is.
I mean, you know, like Beyonce would like do it a little better, like in a few years after that.
Was it Lemonade that she did that with?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, Corbijn's film Control that he does right in the same time period, that was brilliant. So.
Oh, Control, I love. Yeah, that's a great film. But that's not this. That's not this.
It is not this. No.
All right. Well, I like the running order a lot more on Linear, with it starting with Unknown Caller, then Into Breathe, and then the song called Winter we mentioned, then White as Snow, No Line on the Horizon, Fez, Magnificent, Stand-Up Comedy, Get on Your Boots, Moment of Surrender, and finishing with Cedars of Lebanon. Overall, it unfolds better and feels like the kind of record these songs sound like they're part of.
Now, I disagree with you on the running order. I love the sequence, particularly the first four songs that end up on the record. But I will note that initially, Corbin thought that due to all of the changes to the songs and the running order of the album, the film might need to be scrapped altogether. But at the end of the day, the decision was made to keep the running order as it was in July of 2008, but to edit it to use the versions of the songs as they were in December of 2008.
Now, it should be noted that Linear does not include If I Don't Go Crazy, and instead has the aforementioned Winter, which Eno pushed hard to include to no avail. Winter ends up surfacing on the soundtrack for the Jim Sheridan film called Brothers that would come out later in 2009.
I like Winter too, particularly the Brothers film version. I think that's superior to the more straightforward rock and roll version of the song that appears in Linear. Although I think it's interesting to kind of look at both of those.
I like Winter too, especially Edge's rather Radioheadish guitar playing on that Linear version, which I actually prefer, along with those great backing vocals at the end. And since that's the version that the band considered including on the record, let's take a listen to that.
At 21, I was born a son. And on that day I knew I could kill to protect the ones. We put bullets in guns or anything it takes to take a life until it's dead.
Both Winter and White as Snow were written for the Brothers film, but only Winter appears over the film's end credits. Both songs were written from the point of view of or inspired by that film's characters.
And speaking of characters, Bono told Q Magazine right before the record came out, quote, "I'm sick of me. I'm sick of Bono and I am him." That might be glib, but as an artist, I felt it was a little limiting to be in the first person, so I allowed myself just to wear the clothes of the characters that wandered into my imagination. A traffic cop, a junkie, a soldier serving in Afghanistan, end quote. Now, I love this idea. I certainly can respect him for wanting to branch out to more storytelling and become less first person. But as I just mentioned, I think it's very hard for Bono to sink into the characters on this record. His personality, his persona, and overly identifiable voice, at least at points, overwhelms some of these tracks. It's like, after a while, Jack Nicholson's own persona started to become too big to morph into character. And I think with this record, one of the problems is Bono starts to become bigger than the singer in U2. What say you?
I think Bono making a point to say he was singing in character may have been a part of the issue, because, you know, when you're looking for that disconnect, much in the same way the album suffered from his pronouncements about its experimentation and transformational qualities. And it's not like Bono hadn't already donned characters in the past. I'm thinking about, you know, The Flies on stage. I'm thinking about Zooropa, Babyface, Stay, The Wanderer. But to your point, I agree. Bono is not a method or character actor, and he kind of always does peek through.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's not just about donning a character. It's, you know, it's about becoming a character in a convincing way. And, you know, his singing approach on, you know, the Zooropa songs you mentioned, you know, was totally different. you know, he was able to become those characters because he lowered himself into those roles rather than like bellowing over the songs, which is something, you know, at least for me, he does a few times on No Line on the Horizon.
Well, I think we disagree on the effectiveness of Bono's bellowing, as you say. Now, as we've mentioned, U2 delivered the long-awaited No Line on the Horizon in December of 2008 to their record company, Universal Music, owner of Mercury Island and Interscope Records, if you are keeping track. The album had a scheduled release date of February 27, 2009 in Ireland, March 2nd of that year in the UK and Europe, and March 3rd in North America. But some fans didn't need to wait quite that long to hear the songs. First, a 30-second clip of the album's first single, Get On Your Boots, was leaked on the internet in late January 2009, well ahead of its expected digital release date of February the 15th, 2009. And wisely, the band just decided to release the song on iTunes and stream it on U2.com directly after the leak. And then, in early February, Walmart accidentally released a 30-second preview of all the songs before quickly removing that preview. But the biggest and really kind of comical leak was all on Universal Music. Initially, to minimize the risks of leaks, Universal invited journalists to come to listening parties to review the album rather than sending out promo copies. And the promo copies that did get sent out were watermarked with the identity of each recipient. Well, almost 2 weeks before release date, Universal's Australian online music store, getmusic.com, accidentally released the album for digital sales on February 18th, 2009, almost 2 weeks before schedule.
In any case, when it was finally released to Eno and Lenoir's ears, the end product was barely recognizable from the material recorded in Morocco 18 months earlier. Reportedly, a clash of philosophies had emerged between Eno, Lenoir, and U2, particularly after the band turned to Will.i.am and Steve Lillywhite down the homestretch. Lenoir, who had gone on record saying that the album was fantastically innovative in the weeks leading up to its completion, was reportedly so disheartened by U2's U-turn that he and the band were barely on speaking terms by the end of the mixing stage. As for Eno, other than a moment of surrender, he's made no secret about his disappointment. So it's interesting that even after U2 brokers that peace offering with Eno and Lenoir by bringing them in as co-writers, a bitter feeling remained after they do the record. And the fact is, No Line on the Horizon is the last record Eno and Lenoir have produced for U2, at least as things stand now. In any case, I can tell you I'd been following the news of the making of this record, so like I said, I was super curious about how it would end up sounding. Melody, where was your head at when this record came out?
Well, like everyone else, I had heard Boots. I didn't hate the song, still don't hate the song, but I could reconcile that song with all of the hype about Morocco, transformation, and all the rest. I was just hoping that it would all make sense when I heard the whole album.
Okay. This is basically the last U2 record that was predominantly listened to on CD. So let's hear what it sounded like when you slipped the disc into the tray and the title track came booming out of your speakers. Well, this is going to be fun. Melody and I basically disagree about everything on this song.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one.
Okay, I will start. Bono said the view from his house on Killiney Hill, overlooking Dublin Bay, appeared to him like the sea and the sky becoming one. And when he saw a photo taken by Hiroshi Sugimoto of Lake Constance, where Germany, Switzerland, and Austria meet, it inspired not only the writing of No Line on the Horizon's title track, but it became the album cover. Now, naturally, when the record came out, the keyboard warriors of the world cried out it looked like two other album covers by Brotham States, as well as Richard Chartier and Taylor Dupree, who also used photos by Sugimoto showing the sea, sky, and horizon. But I doubt those artists made the kind of deal U2 made with Sugimoto. U2 told Sugimoto if they let him use his photo, he could use U2's music. Not a bad deal for Sugimoto, I say. Now, I've got other quibbles I'll get to, but I'll say it again. I just think Fez Being Born would have been the far better choice to start this album, because this is not the great opening salvo we've grown accustomed to. You know, something that announces the record's intent and answers the last record, like Sort of Homecoming, Streets, Zoo Station, or Vertigo. In fact, other than Helter Skelter on Rattle and Hum, which is a cover, this is my least favorite opening song on any U2 album, at least until the next record, but I'll try to hold my tongue.
Well, as I mentioned a bit ago, I love the first four tracks on this album. I think they are wonderful creations that work well together as the opening third of the album. It's following these tracks that I think things get a little shaky. We'll get to that later. Now, there were three songs in the running to be openers on the album: the title track, Fez Being Born, as you mentioned, and then also Get on Your Boots. My feeling is that Fez is well positioned on the final running order. Speaking of boots, that would have been, in my opinion, a really bad opening choice, even though I assume it was considered as a type of Vertigo rock and roll single opening statement type of thing. But Boots just isn't particularly indicative of what's going on the rest of the album. So for me, the title track as the opener is, as Goldilocks would say, just right. It's an up-tempo rock and roll song with enough innovative elements embedded to be a good opening statement here.
All right. Danny Lanois said this song came about very quickly in Fez when Larry was trying out a few beats and Brian Eno, who was stationed next to Larry in a circle of the six of them in the Riad, sampled the beat and everyone jumped on it, including Larry playing on top of it. And off they went on what they called space age rock. But you mentioned its innovation. I gotta say, I don't find it that forward-leaning. In fact, I think it's pretty reductive, at least rhythmically. It's basically Madchester circa 1990, something Charlatans UK or Happy Mondays did, which U2 already took inspiration from on Octoon Baby.
And we disagree there as well. I love the song's subtle pulsing epicness built by Eno's droning, which I do think sounds a little space-aged or sci-fi, certainly in the synths, something that it shares with the Being Born portion of Fez Being Born. And I think Larry's hard and persistent drumming gives the songs a unique feel.
Maybe, but it's buried in the mix. But we'll get to that in a second. Now, the heavy guitar sound was courtesy of Ben Curtis, former guitarist for Secret Machines, now with School of Seven Bells, who gave the Edge a distortion pedal made by Death by Audio, and that became the defining sound of not only this song, but for Fez Being Born. Okay, so let's move on lyrically. Mm-hmm. I see this as being in awe of the ethereal mysteries of one Allie Hewson. She's many things to him. She's like the sea. She dreams big. Infinity is a great place to start. Nothing matters when he's with her. Time is irrelevant, that sort of thing. But then it could be a personification of the wisdom of a goddess. After all, Bono did say, we sing about God and women, and we sometimes get the two mixed up. Or it could be about how the only difference between heaven and earth is a state of consciousness. The whole kingdom of heaven is here and now. And of course, there are a whole other set of interpretations about the daily experience belonging to a linear concept, blah, blah, blah. But quite honestly, Melody, it makes my head hurt. And then there's already a Reddit thread about how we're eggheads for overanalyzing everything. Now, isn't there?
Well, Bill, we might just end up on another Reddit thread because I really think these lyrics are great. We have Bono going back to a more painterly approach to world building, much more akin to the image sketching in parts of The Unforgettable Fire and Zooropa. So my take is that the lyrics celebrate the ideas of dichotomy or contrasts, changeability, and the mystery of interconnectedness. The verses all tie together in an interesting way. First, you have this image of a woman who's as changeable as the sea, right? Pretty common metaphor, nothing special. But then the woman leads the singer to the ideas that, as you mentioned, infinity is a great place to start and time is irrelevant. It's not linear, which really are big philosophical and scientific ideas. And these ideas inspire the singer and lead to the interconnectedness that we get in the line, "The songs in your head are now on my mind." And that interconnectedness inspires creativity. The singer is dreaming and, quote, hatching some plot, scheming some scheme.
Well, we do agree about something, Melody. That will get us on another Reddit thread. Well played.
Okay. All right. All right. But here, stay with me.
Oh, okay.
Then finally, the singer is transformed from that dreaming state into a traffic cop on the Rue du Mirail.
Mariah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, anyone that speaks French. And throughout the song, the line, "no line on the horizon," takes different shapes and meanings depending on what's going on in the verses. I think generally Bono is a great lyricist, but these lyrics have quite an intellectualism to them, which I really enjoy.
And I'm glad, Melody.
I do.
But, you know, I think, but those lines about the traffic cop, I mean, to me feel shoved into the song to try and connect it to the linear film. I mean, what does the first part of the song have to do with the Parisian cop who gets fed up and takes a road trip to Tripoli? I mean, I don't, that feels inserted to me.
Well, I mean, I really do feel that or see that interconnectedness, the inspiration, this creativity and transformation does with Bono. He transforms himself into this character that leads us into the rest of the album.
But I'll tell you what really keeps me from loving this track, and that's Bono's voice. To me here, it's grating. It's up there in the upper reaches of his range, something that is no longer the pleasure it was to hear in his late 20s. Plus, I have a long-standing belief a singer needs to leave himself some place to go over the course of a song, and here he shoots his wad before the record is even a verse long. And he never lets up, even when the dynamics shift down for that verse, "every night I have the same dream, I'm hatching some plot, scheming some scheme." You know, he doesn't come down to meet the music. He's still on blast in his upper register. Let's listen to that.
Just some plot, scheming some scheme, oh yeah. Oh. I'm a traffic cop, Rue du Mirail.
Well, Bill, guess what? We disagree on that too.
Wait a minute, I haven't convinced you that I'm right? I haven't done that yet?
Sorry. Oh. I love this melody line and the insistent delivery of the verses, which, you know, I do think is set off by that calmer delivery in the chorus.
I do like the chorus. We agree on one thing. I do like the chorus. But let me say, this song, stand-up comedy, and parts of Breathe, you know, these are the ones that really feel the bellowing Bono that I mentioned before. You know, I'm not talking about him not hitting notes, because he does, but there's more to singing than hitting notes. You know this. I'm talking about finding ways to embody the character. And like I said earlier, Bono starts to overwhelm some of these songs by his sheer Bonodom. you know, this is a long way off from what he was able to do on Octoon Baby, Zaropa, and Pop. I do love his singing on Moment of Surrender and like White as Snow, a couple others, you know, but on this song and a couple others, like I said, I just start to get ear fatigue.
Well, I think we will just have to agree to disagree on this one.
But wait, there's more. Another problem I have with this song is the mix. It's like this sheen of white noise with over-the-top vocals that are too high in the mix, and the rhythm section is too buried. There's just nothing anchoring things. It's a mess.
Not surprisingly, the mix doesn't bother me a bit. I think the feel of it gives the song a sense of being relentless and hypnotic all at once.
But who can go under hypnosis when there's some guy bellowing away? I mean, I can't get lost in the music.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I really do manage to get lost in it, especially during the choruses and that ending, you know, whoa, whoa, whoa part.
That's just more bellowing. All right. Anyway, there is an alternative mix that the band argued over right down to the wire. That one has a more processed guitar rather than the heavily distorted one on the album version. And you get a lot more clarity in the rhythm section. You can hear it on the B-side of the Get On Your Boots single. So why don't we listen to version 2 of the song? I actually prefer that version, but it still doesn't capture the essence of the song. Look, there are songs that are just not good, and there are good songs that are trying to get out, but are held back by some element or are buried. And that's how I feel about this song.
Well, I do like version 2 of the song as well, not as much as what ended up on the record. You know, Bill, you're always one to say that all parts of a song need to work for it to work as a whole. And for me, this song is a symphony.
Well, my friend, I was right. That was fun. All right, shall we move on?
Let's do it. Let's listen to Magnificent. Are well known for their sonic layering and the textures of guitar and synthesizer that Edge and Eno pack over the heartbeat rhythm in the first 45 seconds or so of this song are wonderful pops of ear delightment. This is one of my favorite moments on the album. And then Larry and Adam burst out into a sort of Euro dance beat, which probably explains why the song was originally called French Disco. I find it to be at once a surprising song that also feels familiar.
Yes, this is the song that most elicits that familiar feeling, like, oh, there's that U2. Everything a longtime U2 fan needed to hear to keep the faith. And yet, for some reason, Get On Your Boots was chosen as the first single. But we'll get to that. Magnificent was one of the first improvisations that happened in Fez as the six of them jammed with a local percussionist. As you mentioned, it was originally called French Disco, and you can hear that. I mean, you really got to give some love to Adam and Larry for giving this song a great galloping feeling, almost a weightless quality that serves it up for the Edge to deliver one of his most joyful riffs ever. It's like this shimmering beauty. I like Magnificent. I think it's a tad long, but I do love the vibe here. Definitely a standout track.
Yeah, I really love this song. And here's another great melody line and delivery from Bono, in my opinion. You mentioned joyful, which I think is a good descriptor for the song. It's also got a quiet, epic feel to it. And you also mentioned earlier, Bill, that Bono said he wanted this album to contain future hymns. And I think you can hear just the germination, the seed of that idea here.
Yes, Bono said, and I quote, "All music for me is worship of one kind or another," end quote. And this song is obviously a song of praise, like All Because of You, another song of praise. You can take it as singing about a muse, a lover, a mother, or God. Personally, I think there's just too much evidence to the contrary to deny it's about God. In fact, I would go so far as to say this might be the most overt song of praise since the October record, albeit a better reading here. What say you?
Yeah, I think that the multiple perspectives on love, you know, are intentional, but Bono has said the lyrics were in part inspired by the Magnificat, which is from the first chapter in the book of Luke.
I caught that too. With the lines, "Justified till we die, you and I will magnify the magnificent," from the Magnificat, or Mary's Song, as it's come to be known by some, "My soul magnifies the Lord, magnify the magnificent."
Yeah, and I think one of the themes from the Magnificat, praising God for being chosen by God, is in there too. I'm talking about the verse starting with, "I was born to sing for you." Quite an interesting choice for a guy who's often accused of being a megalomaniac.
Well, that's Bono's essence to a T, isn't it? His devotion has always served as a temperance to his ego. Anyway, that verse also channels King David and the Psalms, Bono's favorite of sources. He put a new song in my mouth, "Our God to Magnify." You mentioned the lines, I was born to sing for you. But going further, "I didn't have a choice but to lift you up and sing whatever song you wanted me to. I gave you back my voice. From the womb, my first cry, it was a joyful noise."
Yeah, and that's also a reference to Psalm 100, which begins, "Make a joyful noise unto the Lord."
Okay, well, why don't we listen to that part?
Yeah, let's do it.
Bono said it was about two lovers holding on to each other and trying to turn their lives into worship, which I think is another of Bono's attempts to engage in a little misdirection to throw people off the scent. Nothing new there. Daniel Lanois said, quote, "We wanted to have something euphoric. We wanted to talk about sacrifice that one makes for one's medium or one's art. I thought it had a setting of New York in the 50s, looking out a small bedroom window, maybe a Charlie Parker kind of figure. That's what we started with. We placed ourselves in Charlie Parker's body," end quote. I'm not sure that comes through in the song, but if they found inspiration from it, great.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do agree with you there. Now, before we move on, I'll add that Magnificent was released as the second single from the album in May of 2009. The single did do well in some countries. It went to number one in Scotland, number five in Canada and Ireland, and also made the top 20 in several other countries, including France, the Netherlands, Italy, and Sweden. But it didn't fare so well in the UK single charts, only reaching number 42 there and only getting to number 79 on the US singles charts. Not the big hit, certainly, that the band were hoping for. Okay, so what do we have up next, Bill?
We've got Moment of Surrender. This one really is a masterpiece.
Agreed. I think it's the emotional core of the record.
And that it came together so magically only makes it all the more beloved in U2 lore. This is another one from Fez, but where so many of the tunes from Fez went through dramatic iterations later on, this one came together completely in one magical take and basically stayed intact. Brian Eno called the song's recording the most amazing studio experience I've ever had.
Yes. And the song started from a drum loop Eno had created and invited the band to improvise over. Now, there was something that was off in that loop that Eno was trying to sort out. There was a sort of lopsidedness in the rhythm, which Eno compared to, quote, a wheeled carriage that had one of the wheels cracked, unquote. But while Eno was attempting to fix it, Larry started playing along on a malfunctioning electronic drum kit with intermittent hi-hat dropouts. And something in that off-kilter rhythm had the germ of magic.
Yes, and after a quick discussion about the chord changes and the odd meter, which wasn't based on either eighths or sixteenths, the six of them then improvised the entirety of the piece. All praise to Danny Lenoir, who came up with the gospel-tinged chorus, which he said was a tribute to the band, calling it a, quote, Simcoe sound, end quote, which is a town in Ontario, Canada. Bono said when they were recording, he'd motion to Lenoir when the chorus was coming and have Danny lead the chorus. Really beautiful harmonies on that chorus. Was amazed by each performer's ability to develop and play their part without any instructions or cues. And after they finished the take, everyone in the studio, including a gathering of production personnel and visitors, was completely silent. Eno said it was as if they had gone on an emotional adventure of some kind. Bono said, usually we go into the studio to find music. Well, this time it found us.
Yes. And I've got to say, as much as I love the musical introduction with the beautifully broken rhythms and that sort of gospel dirge sound of the keyboards that swell into that crescendo, the song reaches a whole other level when Adam's amazing funk, transy bass line comes in.
Yes, this is Adam's finest moment of the record. His part was originally based on the Grandmaster Mel Mel song, White Lines, Don't Do It, before he changed to a more trance-like bass line midstream. I had mentioned on the All That You Can't Leave Behind episode that as the band moved towards more conventional songwriting, it marginalized Adam's strengths, which tend to come out when the band is improvising, and he has the freedom to create more. Well, Moment of Surrender is right in Adam's wheelhouse, and I think he's a big reason why they caught magic on this one.
Oh, agreed. Now, why don't we go ahead and talk about the lyrics? Bono has said he wrote the song from the point of view of a drug addict. It's about a lost soul's quest for redemption.
Right. It's about a crisis of faith, a spiritual epiphany, a junkie's final fall from grace. As for Bono, here's one he brilliantly falls into character of that heroin addict, in the haze of a fix, looking for redemption and deliverance. In this stream of consciousness narrative, the world walks by and he's not seen in plain sight. He's hit rock bottom, his moment of surrender, borrowing a phrase from Alcoholics Anonymous, when an addict admits being powerless and is finally ready to get help.
Yeah, and of course, you know, you can clearly see that story in the song. But the lyrics are written broadly enough that it transcends the specific character and is relatable to whatever demon or external force has crushed you. And I think, you know, we have to mention that it has one of Bono's most iconic lyrics. I was punching in the numbers at the ATM machine. I could see in the reflection a face staring back at me at the moment of surrender, a vision over visibility.
Yeah, this is one of Bono's greatest vocals ever. He's working to his strengths and delivers a stunning vocal. Eno called Bono's singing so heartbreaking, agonized, and vulnerable, a knife to the heart.
Yeah, I agree. It's powerful, intimate, and penitent all at once. Now, I mentioned that much of the original version of the song, the original improvisation from Fez, made it onto the final record. But during the mixing of the song, the band decided to drop a verse to shorten the length, but Eno was vehemently opposed to that idea.
Yeah, Eno was outraged that U2 wanted to shorten the song, and he was adamant that the band not alter it in any way, saying, quote, "These fucking guys, they're supposed to be so spiritual. They don't spot a miracle when it hits them in the face." In fact, Eno told the band they should make it the first single because they were the only band that could get it on the radio. Interesting.
And that's true.
Yeah. This is the best song of what will probably be known as the last phase of the band's career. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
So if you're good, I'm ready to move on. What do we got up next?
Well, let's go ahead and take a listen to Unknown Caller.
Song that came out of one of the early jams in Fez. This might be the most overt example of Moroccan influence, at least so far as the Sufi inspired chanting.
Yeah, and we also have the sounds of Moroccan swallows that were added to the introduction that also provides more atmosphere from the Fez sessions.
Look, the track starts promisingly with the sunlit, dreamlike intro and Edge's guitar work, which is typically strong, and Bono's plaintive sunshine, that sort of thing, like that. Mm-hmm. But for me, as the song unfolds, something feels amiss. Maybe it's the fact that the lyrics are so tied to computer speak of the time. I mean, who says force quit, move to trash, restart, reboot, password enter here? Sounds like a beginner's course in computer use for people over 70. I mean, honestly, it's hard to take seriously, which is a shame because I know the subject matter is deeply emotional. I do. But man.
Now, Bill, I'll admit that the Mac references do sound a little clunky and dated, yeah. But I love this song. I love its quirkiness. I love how it moves from an optimistic opening and descends lyrically and musically into something much heavier. Again, we have a song from the point of view of an addict, maybe the same character from Moment of Surrender. But this time he's on a bender. He's having a breakdown and speed dialing God.
Yeah, I mean, there is a live version where Bono says it's about a suicidal man alone in a hotel room holding a gun and a cell phone. And at the height of the darkness, his cell phone begins receiving texts. He doesn't know who is texting, could be God, could be his mates, but somehow he listens and somehow it gets him out of the hotel room alive. So that could be this verse: I was lost between the midnight and the dawning in a place of no consequence or company. 333, when the numbers fell off the clock face, speed dialing with no signal at all, go shout it out, rise up. 333, of course, references Jeremiah, call unto me and I will answer. And of course, the All That You Can't Leave Behind album also has the 333 reference as well.
Yeah, on the cover. But the last part of that verse is, and show you great and mighty things which you know not, which I think is the key to this song. I think we are hearing God's end of the conversation in those chanted choruses. Go shout it out, rise up, escape yourself and gravity. Why don't we go ahead and listen to that part?
Lenoir said, similar to Moment of Surrender, it came early on in Fez with a great vibe to it. That guitar solo at the end was right from the backing track. It pretty much had its personality intact from day one. Bono honed in on the lyrics, but they did not go through any laborious process, end quote. I also like the French horns and the repeating da, 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 da. That's nice. And then Edge's solo that Lenoir talked about is a bit of a marvel. In fact, Edge's longtime guitar tech, Dallas Hsu, calls it, quote, one of Edge's major solos in his life. You won't hear better than that on any other song, end quote. Not sure I agree with that, but I do think it's a fantastic, penetrating solo.
Yeah, I love that transition from the French horn to Edge's exalted solo, which sonically brings the song full circle back to a state of hopefulness.
I respect what they were trying to do here, and I'm glad the song made the record rather than, say, another song aiming for a hit. But for me, the song meanders a bit, and the language of the lyrics is just so distracting for me. Those computer references, it's just hard to get over. Sorry.
And for me, this song really works.
Okay, then. Where are we going next?
Well, we're going to push pause here.
Oh, okay. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. We have to do a two-parter, should I?
Well, not at this point in our podcast history, no.
Right. Fair enough. Well, before we sign off, is it fair to say that No Line on the Horizon is a record split into thirds?
You know, it really is. The first four songs most represent the spirit of Fez. The next three, which we'll talk about next time, are the more pop-oriented numbers. And then the last third is basically a combination of the two. But we'll get into all that next time on the Into the Heart of U2 podcast.